This is an Audio Renaissance Tapes presentation of Emotional Intelligence, written by Daniel Goleman, adapted for audio by Richard O'Connor, produced by Paul Rubin, and read by the author, Dr. Daniel Goleman.
Aristotle said, "Anyone could get angry, that's easy. But to be angry with the right person, to the right degree, at the right time, for the right purpose, and in the right way, that's not so easy." Aristotle's words are in stark contrast with some items from this week's paper. 8 youngsters are wounded when an inadvertent bump in a crowd of teenagers milling outside a Manhattan rap club leads to a shoving match, which ends when one of those affronted starts shooting a .38 caliber automatic handgun into the crowd. The report notes that such shootings over seemingly minor slights, which are perceived as acts of disrespect, have become increasingly common around the country in recent years. For murder victims under 12, 57% of the murderers are their parents or step-parents. In almost half the cases, the parents say they were merely trying to discipline the child. The fatal beatings were prompted by infractions such as the child blocking the TV, crying, or soiling diapers. A German youth is on trial for murdering 5 Turkish women and girls in a fire he set while they slept. Part of a neo-Nazi group, he tells of failing to hold jobs, of drinking, of blaming his hard luck on foreigners. In a barely audible voice, he pleads, "I can't stop being sorry for what we've done, and I'm infinitely ashamed." Each day's news comes to us rife with reports of the disintegration of civility and safety, an onslaught of mean-spirited impulse running amok. But the news simply reflects back to us on a larger scale a creeping sense of emotions out of control. No one is insulated from this erratic tide of outburst and regret. It reaches into all of our lives in one way or another. This audio tape is a guide to making sense of the senselessness. As a psychologist, and for the last decade as a journalist for the New York Times, I've been tracking the progress of our scientific understanding of the realm of the irrational. From that perch, I have been struck by 2 opposing trends, one portraying a growing calamity in our shared emotional life, the other offering some hopeful remedies. The last decade, despite its bad news, has also seen an unparalleled burst of scientific studies of emotion. Most dramatic are the glimpses of the brain at work, made possible by innovative methods such as new brain imaging technologies. Such findings offer a challenge to those who subscribe to a narrow view of intelligence and who argue that IQ is a genetic given that cannot be changed by life experience and that our destiny in life is largely fixed by these aptitudes. That argument ignores the more challenging question: what can we change that will help our children fare better in life? What factors are at play, for example, when people of high IQ flounder and those of modest IQ do surprisingly well? I would argue that the difference quite often lies in the abilities called here emotional intelligence, which include self-control, zeal and persistence, the ability to motivate oneself, and empathy. And these skills, as we shall see, can be taught to children, giving them a better chance in life. Aristotle's challenge is to manage our emotional life with intelligence. Our passions, when well exercised, have wisdom. They guide our thinking, our values, our very survival. But they can easily go awry and do so all too often. As Aristotle saw, the problem is not with emotionality, but with the appropriateness of emotion and its expression. The question is, how can we bring intelligence to our emotions, and civility to our streets, and caring to our communal life? Ponder the last moments of Gary and Mary Jane Chauncey, a couple completely devoted to their 11-year-old daughter Andrea, who was confined to a wheelchair by cerebral palsy. The Chauncey family were on an Amtrak train that crashed into a river after a barge hit and weakened a railroad bridge in Louisiana's Bayou Country. Thinking first of their daughter, the couple tried their best to save Andrea as water rushed into the sinking train. Somehow they managed to push her through a window to rescuers. Then, as the car sank beneath the water, they perished. As an insight into the purpose and potency of emotions, This exemplary act of parental heroism testifies to the role of altruistic love and every other emotion we feel in human life. It suggests that our deepest feelings, our passions and longings, are essential guides, and that our species owes much of its existence to their power in human affairs. That power is extraordinary. Only a potent love, the urgency of saving a cherished child, could lead a parent to override the impulse for personal survival. Seen from the intellect, their self-sacrifice was arguably irrational. Seen from the heart, it was the only choice to make. A view of human nature that ignores the power of emotions is sadly short-sighted. As we all know from experience, when it comes to shaping our decisions and our actions, feeling counts every bit as much as thought. We've gone too far in emphasizing the value and import of the purely rational of what IQ measures in human life. For better or worse, intelligence can come to nothing when the emotions hold sway. It was a tragedy of errors. 14-year-old Matilda Crabtree was just playing a practical joke on her father. She jumped out of a closet and yelled boo as her parents came home at 1 a.m. from visiting friends. But Bobby Crabtree and his wife thought Matilda was staying with other friends that night. Hearing noises as he entered the house, Crabtree reached for his .357 caliber pistol and went into Matilda's bedroom to investigate. When his daughter jumped from the closet, Crabtree shot her in the neck. Matilda died 12 hours later. One emotional legacy of evolution is the fear that mobilizes us to protect our family from danger. That impulse impelled Bobby Crabtree to get his gun and search his house for the intruder he thought was prowling there. Fear primed Crabtree to shoot before he could fully register what he was shooting at, even before he could recognize his daughter's voice. Automatic reactions of this sort have become etched in our nervous system, evolutionary biologists presume, because for a long and crucial period in human prehistory they made the difference between survival and death. For better or for worse, our appraisal of every personal encounter and our responses to it are shaped not just by our rational judgments or our personal history, but also by our distant ancestral past. This leaves us with sometimes tragic propensities, as witnessed the sad events at the Crabtree household. In short, we too often confront postmodern dilemmas with an emotional repertoire tailored to the urgencies of the Pleistocene age. That predicament is at the heart of my subject. One early spring day, I was driving along a highway over a mountain pass in Colorado, when a snow flurry suddenly blotted out a car a few lengths ahead of me. Pressing my foot on the brake, I could feel anxiety flood my body and hear the thumping of my heart. The anxiety built to full fear, I pulled over to the side of the road, waiting for the flurry to pass. A half hour later, the snow stopped, visibility returned, and I continued on my way, only to be stopped a few hundred yards down the road where an ambulance crew was helping a passenger in a car. The car had rear-ended a slower car in front. The collision blocked the highway. If I had continued driving in the blinding snow, I probably would have hit them. The caution that fear forced on me that day may have saved my life. I was overtaken by an internal state that compelled me to stop, pay attention, and take heed of a coming danger. All emotions are, in essence, impulses to act, the instant plans for handling life that evolution has instilled in us. In our emotional repertoire, each emotion plays a unique role. With anger, blood flows to the hands, making it easier to grasp a weapon or strike at a foe. Heart rate increases, and a rush of hormones, such as adrenaline, generates a pulse of energy strong enough for vigorous action. With fear, blood goes to the large skeletal muscles, such as in the legs, making it easier to flee. Among the main biological changes in happiness is increased activity in a brain center that inhibits negative feelings and fosters an increase in available energy and a quieting of those that generate worrisome thought. Love, tender feelings, and sexual satisfaction are the physiological opposite of the fight-or-flight mobilization shared by fear and anger. The lifting of the eyebrows in surprise allows the taking in of a larger visual sweep and also permits more light to strike the retina. This offers more information about the unexpected event, making it easier to figure out exactly what's going on and concoct the best plan for action. Around the world, an expression of disgust looks the same and sends the identical message. something is offensive in taste or smell, or metaphorically so. The facial expression of disgust, the upper lip curled to the side as the nose wrinkles slightly, suggests a primordial attempt to close the nostrils against a noxious odor or to spit out a poisonous food. A main function for sadness is to help adjust to a significant loss, such as the death of someone close or a major disappointment. Sadness brings a drop in energy and enthusiasm for life's activities, and as it deepens and approaches depression, slows the body's metabolism. This loss of energy may well have kept saddened and vulnerable early humans close to home, where they were safer. While in the ancient past a hair-trigger anger may have offered a crucial edge for survival, the availability of automatic weaponry to 13-year-olds has made it too often a disastrous reaction. A friend was telling me about her divorce, a painful separation. She was saying that her independence was appealing to her, that she was happy to be on her own. "I just don't think about him anymore. I really don't care," she said. But as she said it, her eyes momentarily welled up with tears. That moment of teary eyes could easily pass unnoted, but the watering eyes meant she's sad despite her words to the contrary. One is an act of the emotional mind, the other of the rational mind. In a very real sense, we have two minds, one that thinks and one that feels. These two fundamentally different ways of knowing interact to construct our mental life. One, the rational mind, is the mode of comprehension we are typically conscious of, more prominent in awareness, thoughtful, able to ponder and reflect. But alongside that, there's another system of knowing, impulsive and powerful, if sometimes illogical, the emotional mind. The emotional-rational dichotomy approximates the folk distinction between heart and head. Knowing something is right in your heart is a different order of conviction, somehow a deeper kind of certainty, than thinking so with your rational mind. These two minds, the emotional and the rational, operate in tight harmony for the most part, intertwining their very different ways of knowing to guide us through the world. In many or most moments, these two minds are exquisitely coordinated. Feelings are essential to thought, thought to feeling. But when passions surge, the balance tips. It's the emotional mind that captures the upper hand, swamping the rational mind. To better grasp the potent hold of the emotions on the thinking mind, and why feeling and reason are so readily at war, consider how the brain evolved. Human brains are about triple the size of those in our nearest cousins in evolution, the non-human primates. Over millions of years of evolution, the brain has grown from the bottom up, with its higher centers developing as elaborations of lower, more ancient parts. The most primitive part of the brain, shared with all species that have more than a minimal nervous system, is the brainstem surrounding the top of the spinal cord. This root brain regulates basic life functions like breathing and the metabolism of the body's other organs. This primitive brain can't be said to think or learn. Rather, it's a set of pre-programmed regulators that keep the body running as it should and reacting in a way that ensures survival. From the most primitive root, the brainstem, emerge the emotional centers. Millions of years later in evolution, from these emotional areas evolved the thinking brain or neocortex, the great bulb of convoluted tissues that make up the brain's top layers. The fact that the thinking brain grew from the emotional reveals much about the relationship of thought to feeling. There was an emotional brain long before there was a rational one. This new addition to the brain allowed the addition of nuance to emotional life. Take love. Limbic structures, the part of the brain that rings and borders the brainstem, generate feelings of pleasure and sexual desire, the emotions that feed sexual passion. But the addition of the neocortex and its connections to the limbic system allowed for the mother-child bond that's the basis of the family unit and the long-term commitment to child-rearing that makes human development possible. Species that have no neocortex, like reptiles, lack maternal affection. When their young hatch, the newborns have to hide to avoid being cannibalized. On a hot August day in 1963, Richard Robles, a seasoned burglar, broke into an apartment that belonged to two young women, Janice Wiley, a researcher at Newsweek magazine, and Emily Hofford, a grade school teacher. Though Robles thought no one would be there, Wiley was home. Threatening her with a knife, Robles tied her up. As he was leaving, Hofford came home. To make good his escape, Robles began to tie her up, too. As Robles tells the tale years later, Janice Wiley warned him she would remember his face and help the police track him down. Robles panicked at that, completely losing control. In a frenzy, he grabbed a soda bottle and clubbed the women until they were unconscious. Then, awash in rage and fear, he slashed and stabbed them over and over with a kitchen knife. Looking back on that moment some 25 years later, Robles laments, "I just went bananas. My head just exploded." Such emotional explosions are neural hijackings. At those moments, evidence suggests, a center in the limbic brain proclaims an emergency, recruiting the rest of the brain to its urgent agenda. The hijacking occurs in an instant, triggering this reaction crucial moments before the neocortex, the thinking brain, has had a chance to glimpse fully what's happening, let alone decide if it's a good idea. The hallmark of such a hijack is that once the moment passes, those so possessed have the sense of not knowing what came over them. These hijacks happen to us with fair frequency. Think back to the last time you lost it, blowing up at someone, your spouse or child, or perhaps the driver of another car, to a degree that later, with some reflection and hindsight, seemed uncalled for. In all probability, that too was such a hijacking, a neural takeover, which, as we shall see, originates in the amygdala, a center in the limbic brain. The hippocampus and the amygdala are two key parts of the primitive nose brain that in evolution gave rise to the cortex and then the neocortex. To this day, these limbic structures do much or most of the brain's learning and remembering. The amygdala is the specialist for emotional matters. If the amygdala is severed from the rest of the brain, the result is a striking inability to gauge the emotional meaning of events. The amygdala acts as a storehouse of emotional memory and thus of significance itself. Life without the amygdala is a life stripped of personal meanings. More than affection is tied to the amygdala, all passion depends on it. Animals that have their amygdala removed lack fear and rage. They lose the urge to compete or cooperate. They no longer have any sense of their place in their kind's social order. Emotion is blunted or absent. Joseph Ledoux, a neuroscientist at the Center for Neuroscience at New York University, was the first to discover the key role of the amygdala in the emotional brain. Ledoux's research explains how the amygdala can take control over what we do, even as the thinking brain, the neocortex, is still coming to a decision. In the brain's architecture, the amygdala is poised something like an alarm company where operators stand ready to send out emergency calls to the fire department, the police, or a neighbor whenever a home security system signals trouble. When it sounds an alarm of, say, fear, it sends urgent messages to every major part of the brain. It triggers the secretion of the body's fight-or-flight hormones, mobilizes the centers for movement, and activates the cardiovascular system, the muscles, and the gut. A friend tells of having been on vacation in England, taking a stroll along a canal. He suddenly saw a girl gazing at the water, her face frozen in fear. Before he knew quite why, he had jumped in the water. Only once he was in the water did he realize that the girl was staring in shock at a toddler who had fallen in, whom he was able to rescue. What made him jump in the water before he knew why? The answer, very likely, was his amygdala. Ledoux's research is revolutionary for understanding emotional life because it's the first to work out neural pathways for feelings that bypass the neocortex. Those feelings that take the direct route through the amygdala include our most primitive and potent. This circuit does much to explain the power of emotion to overwhelm rationality. While the hippocampus remembers the dry facts, the amygdala retains the emotional flavor that goes with those facts. As Ledoux put it to me, the hippocampus is crucial in recognizing a face as that of your cousin, but it's the amygdala that adds you don't really like her. Ledoux turns to the role of the amygdala in childhood to support what has long been a basic tenet of psychoanalytic thought, that the interactions of life's earliest years lay down a set of emotional lessons based on the attunement and upsets in the contacts between infant and caretakers. These emotional lessons are so potent, believes Ledoux, that they're stored in the amygdala as rough, wordless blueprints for emotional life. One reason we can be so baffled by emotional outbursts, then, is that they often date from a time early in our lives when things were bewildering and we didn't yet have words for comprehending events. We may have the chaotic feelings, but not the words for the memories that form them. As Ledoux points out, you don't need to know exactly what something is to know that it might be dangerous. If the amygdala senses a sensory pattern of import emerging, it jumps to a conclusion, triggering its reactions before there's full confirming evidence or any confirmation at all. The brain's damper switch for the amygdala's surges appears to lie in the prefrontal lobes just behind the forehead. The prefrontal cortex seems to be at work when someone is fearful or enraged, but stifles or controls the feeling in order to deal more effectively with the situation at hand. This neocortical area of the brain brings a more analytic or appropriate response to our emotional impulse, modulated in the amygdala and other limbic areas. The neocortical response is slower in brain time than the hijack mechanism because it involves more circuitry. The connections between the amygdala and the neocortex are the hub of the battles or cooperative treaties struck between head and heart, thought and feeling. This circuitry explains why emotion is so crucial to effective thought, both in making wise decisions and in simply allowing us to think clearly. The prefrontal cortex is responsible for working memory, but signals of strong emotions, anxiety, anger, and the like, can create neural static, sabotaging the ability of the prefrontal lobe to maintain working memory. That's why when we're emotionally upset, we say we just can't think straight, and why continual emotional distress can create deficits in a child's intellectual abilities, crippling the capacity to learn. These deficits, if more subtle, aren't always tapped by IQ testing, though they do show up in a child's continual agitation and impulsivity. In one study, for example, primary school boys who had above-average IQ scores but nevertheless were doing poorly in school were found via these neuropsychological tests to have impaired frontal cortex functioning. Consider, too, the role of emotions in even the most rational decision-making. Dr. Antonio Damasio, a neurologist at the University of Iowa College of Medicine, has made careful studies of just what's impaired in patients with damage to the prefrontal amygdala circuit. Their decision-making is terribly flawed, and yet they show no deterioration at all in IQ or any cognitive ability. Despite their intact intelligence, they make disastrous choices in business and their personal lives, and even obsess endlessly over a decision so simple as when to make an appointment. Dr. Damasio argues that their decisions are so bad because they've lost access to their emotional learning. Evidence leads Dr. Damasio to the counterintuitive position that feelings are typically indispensable for rational decisions. They point us in the proper direction, where dry logic can then be of best use. Ordinarily, the complementarity of limbic system and neocortex, amygdala and prefrontal lobes, means each is a full partner in mental life. When these partners interact well, emotional intelligence rises, as does intellectual ability. The old paradigm held an ideal of reason freed of the pull of emotion. The new paradigm urges us to harmonize head and heart. To do that well in our lives means we must first understand more exactly what it means to use emotion intelligently. One of psychology's open secrets is the relative inability of grades, IQ, or SAT scores, despite their popular mystique, to predict unerringly who will succeed in life. To be sure, there's a relationship between IQ and life circumstances for large groups as a whole. Many people with very low IQs end up in menial jobs, and those with high IQs tend to become well-paid, but by no means always. My concern is with emotional intelligence. Abilities such as being able to motivate oneself and persist in the face of frustrations, to control impulse and delay gratification, to regulate one's moods and keep distress from swamping the ability to think, to empathize, and to hope. IQ offers little to explain the different destinies of people with roughly equal promise, schooling, and opportunity. When 95 Harvard students from the classes of the 1940s were followed into middle age, the men with the highest test scores in college weren't particularly successful compared to their lower-scoring peers in terms of salary, productivity, or status in their field. Nor did they have the greatest life satisfaction, nor the most happiness with friendships, family, and romantic relationships. And that's the problem. Academic intelligence offers virtually no preparation for the turmoil or opportunity life's vicissitudes bring. Yet even though a high IQ is no guarantee of prosperity, prestige, or happiness in life, our schools and our culture fixate on academic abilities, ignoring emotional intelligence. Emotional life is a domain that, as surely as math or reading, can be handled with greater or lesser skill and requires its unique set of competencies. Emotional aptitude is a meta-ability, determining how well we can use whatever other skills we have, including raw intellect. Much evidence testifies that people who are emotionally adept, who know and manage their own feelings well, and who read and deal effectively with other people's feelings, are at an advantage in any domain of life, whether romance and intimate relationships are picking up on the unspoken rules that govern success in organizational politics. To the casual observer, 4-year-old Judy might seem a wallflower among her more gregarious playmates. She hangs back from the action at playtime, staying on the margins of games rather than plunging into the center. But Judy is actually a keen observer of the social politics of her preschool classroom, perhaps the most sophisticated of her playmates in her insights into the tides of feeling within the others. Her sophistication is not apparent until Judy's teacher gathers the 4-year-olds around to play what they call the classroom game. The classroom game, a dollhouse replica of Judy's own preschool classroom with stick figures who have for heads small photos of the students and teachers, is a test of social perceptiveness. When Judy's teacher asks her to put each girl and boy in the part of the room they like to play in most, the art corner, the blocks corner, and so on, Judy does so with complete accuracy, and when asked to put each boy and girl with the children they like to play with most, Judy shows she can match best friends for the entire class. Judy's accuracy reveals that she has a perfect social map of her class, a level of perceptiveness exceptional for a 4-year-old. These are the skills that in later life might allow Judy to blossom into a star in any of the fields where people skills count, from sales and management to diplomacy. That Judy's social brilliance was spotted at all, let alone this early, was due to her being a student in Project Spectrum, a curriculum that intentionally cultivates a variety of kinds of intelligence. The guiding visionary behind Project Spectrum is Howard Gardner, a psychologist at the Harvard School of Education. "The time has come," Gardner told me, "to broaden our notion of the spectrum of talents." Project Spectrum recognizes that the human repertoire of abilities goes far beyond the 3 R's, that narrow band of word and number skills that schools traditionally focus on. It acknowledges that capacities such as Judy's social perceptiveness are talents that an education can nurture rather than ignore or even frustrate. By encouraging children to develop a full range of the abilities that they'll actually draw on to succeed, or use simply to be fulfilled in what they do, school becomes an education in life skills. In recent years, a growing group of psychologists agree with Gardner that the old concepts of IQ revolved around a narrow band of linguistic and math skills, and that doing well on IQ tests was most directly a predictor of success in the classroom or as a professor, but less and less so as life's paths diverge from academe. These psychologists have taken a wider view of intelligence, trying to reinvent it in terms of what it takes to lead life successfully. And that line of inquiry leads back to an appreciation of just how crucial personal or emotional intelligence really is. Yale psychologist Peter Salovey subsumes Gardner's personal intelligence in his basic definition of emotional intelligence, expanding these abilities into 5 main domains. The first is knowing one's emotions. Self-awareness, recognizing a feeling as it happens, is the keystone of emotional intelligence. The second is managing emotions, handling feelings so that they're appropriate is an ability that builds on self-awareness. The third, motivating oneself. Fourth, recognizing emotions in others. Empathy, another ability that builds on emotional self-awareness, is the fundamental people skill. The fifth is handling relationships. The art of relationships is, in large part, skill in managing emotions in others. IQ and emotional intelligence are not opposing competencies, but rather separate ones. However, unlike the familiar test for IQ, there is as yet no single paper and pencil test that yields an emotional intelligence score, and there may never be one. A belligerent samurai, an old Japanese tale goes, once challenged a Zen master to explain the concept of heaven and hell. But the monk replied with scorn, "You're nothing but a lout. I can't waste my time with the likes of you." His very honor attacked, the samurai flew into a rage, and pulling his sword from its scabbard, yelled, "I could kill you for your impertinence." "That," the monk calmly replied, "is hell." Startled at seeing the truth in what the master pointed out about the fury that had him in its grip, the samurai calmed down, sheathed his sword, and bowed, thanking the monk for the insight. "And that," said the monk, is heaven. The sudden awakening of the samurai to his own agitated state illustrates the crucial difference between being caught up in a feeling and becoming aware that you're being swept away by it. Socrates' injunction, "Know thyself," speaks to this keystone of emotional intelligence, awareness of one's own feelings as they occur, self-awareness in the sense of an ongoing attention to one's internal states. Self-awareness, in short, means being aware of both our mood and our thoughts about that mood, in the words of John Mayer, a University of New Hampshire psychologist, who with Yale's Peter Salovey is a co-formulator of the theory of emotional intelligence. Self-awareness can be a non-reactive, non-judgmental attention to inner states. Mayer finds that people tend to fall into distinctive styles for attending to and dealing with their emotions. Some people are self-aware. Aware of their moods as they're having them, these people understandably have some sophistication about their emotional lives. Their mindfulness helps them manage their emotions. Some people are engulfed. These are people who often feel swamped by their emotions and helpless to escape them, as though their moods have taken charge. Some people are accepting. While these people are often clear about what they're feeling, they also tend to be accepting of their moods and so don't try to change them. At the extremes, this means that for some people, emotional awareness is overwhelming, while for others it barely exists. Gary infuriated his fiancée, Ellen, because even though he was intelligent, thoughtful, and a successful surgeon, he was emotionally flat, completely unresponsive to any and all shows of feeling. While Gary could speak brilliantly of science and art, when it came to his feelings, even those for Ellen, he fell silent. Try as she might to elicit some passion from him, Gary was impassive, oblivious. "I don't naturally express my feelings," Gary told the therapist he saw at Ellen's insistence. When it came to emotional life, he added, "I don't know what to talk about. I have no strong feelings, either positive or negative." Ellen was not alone in being frustrated by Gary's aloofness. As he confided to his therapist, he was unable to speak openly about his feelings with anyone in his life. The reason? He didn't know what he felt in the first place. So far as he could tell, he had no angers, no sadnesses, no joys. As his own therapist observes, this emotional blankness makes Gary and others like him colorless, bland. They bore everybody. That's why their wives send them into treatment. Gary's emotional flatness exemplifies what psychiatrists call alexithymia. It's not that alexithymics never feel, but that they're unable to know, and especially unable to put into words, precisely what their feelings are. They're utterly lacking in the fundamental skill of emotional intelligence, self-awareness, knowing what we're feeling as emotions roil within us. Alexithymics belie the common-sense notion that it's perfectly self-evident what we're feeling. They haven't a clue. Elliot's tumor, growing just behind his forehead, was the size of a small orange. Surgery removed it completely. Although the surgery was declared a success, afterward people who knew him well said that Elliot was no longer Elliot. He had undergone a drastic personality change. Once a successful corporate lawyer, Elliot could no longer hold a job. His wife left him. Squandering his savings in fruitless investments, he was reduced to living in a spare bedroom at his brother's house. Antonio Damasio, the neurologist Elliot consulted, was struck by one element missing from Elliot's mental repertoire. Though nothing was wrong with his logic, memory, attention, or any other cognitive ability, Elliot was virtually oblivious to his feelings about what had happened to him. Most strikingly, Elliot could narrate the tragic events of his life with complete dispassion, as though he were an onlooker to the losses and failures of his past, without a note of regret or sadness, frustration or anger at life's unfairness. His own tragedy brought him no pain. Damasio felt more upset by Elliot's story than did Elliot himself. The source of this emotional unawareness, Damasio concluded, was the removal, along with the brain tumor, of part of Elliot's prefrontal lobes. In effect, the surgery had severed ties between the lower centers of the emotional brain, especially the amygdala and related circuits, and the thinking abilities of the neocortex. Elliot's thinking had become computer-like, able to make every step in the calculus of a decision, but unable to assign values to differing possibilities. Every option was neutral. And that overly dispassionate reasoning, suspected Damasio, was the core of Elliot's problem. Too little awareness of his own feelings about things made Elliot's reasoning faulty. The handicap showed up even in mundane decisions. When Damasio tried to choose a time and date for the next appointment with Elliot, the result was a muddle of indecisiveness. Elliot could find arguments for and against every date and time that Damasio proposed, but could not choose among them. At the rational level, there were perfectly good reasons for objecting to or accepting virtually every possible time for the appointment. But Elliot lacked any sense of how he felt about any of the times. Lacking that awareness of his own feelings, he had no preferences at all. The intuitive signals that guide us in these moments come in the form of limbic-driven surges from the viscera that Damasio calls somatic markers, literally, gut feelings. The somatic marker is a kind of automatic alarm, typically calling attention to a potential danger from a given course of action. More often than not, these markers steer us away from some choice that experience warns us against, though they can also alert us to a golden opportunity. A sense of self-mastery, of being able to withstand the emotional storms that the buffeting of fortune brings, rather than being slave to passion, has been praised as a virtue since the time of Plato. The Romans and the early Christian church called it temperance, the restraining of emotional excess. The goal is balance, not emotional suppression. Every feeling has its value and significance. But as Aristotle observed, what's wanted is appropriate emotion, feeling proportionate to circumstance. When emotions are too muted, they create dullness and distance. When out of control, too extreme and persistent, they become pathological, as in immobilizing depression, overwhelming anxiety, raging anger, or manic agitation. Still, managing our emotions is something of a full-time job. Much of what we do, especially in our free time, is an attempt to manage mood. Everything from reading a novel or watching TV to the activities and companions we choose can be a way to make ourselves feel better. The art of soothing ourselves is a fundamental life skill. Some psychoanalytic thinkers see this as one of the most essential of all psychic tools. The theory holds that emotionally sound infants learn to soothe themselves by treating themselves as their caretakers have treated them, leaving them less vulnerable to the upheavals of the emotional brain. Say someone in another car cuts dangerously close to you as you're driving on the freeway. If your reflexive thought is, "That son of a bitch," it matters immensely for the trajectory of rage whether that thought is followed by more thoughts of outrage and revenge, like, "He could have hit me, that bastard. I can't let him get away with that." Your knuckles whiten as you tighten your hold on the steering wheel, a surrogate for strangling his throat. Your body mobilizes to fight, not run, leaving you trembling, beads of sweat on your forehead, your heart pounding, the muscles in your face locked in a scowl. Contrast that sequence of building rage with a more charitable line of thought toward the driver who cut you off. Something like, "Maybe he didn't see me, or maybe he had some good reason for driving so carelessly, like a medical emergency." That line of possibility tempers anger with mercy, or at least an open mind, short-circuiting the buildup of rage. The problem, as Aristotle's challenge to have only appropriate anger reminds us, is that more often than not, our anger surges out of control. Ben Franklin put it well. "Anger," said he, "is never without a reason, but seldom a good one." Of all the moods that people want to escape, rage seems to be the most intransigent. Diana Tice, a psychologist at Case Western Reserve University, found that anger is the mood people are worst at controlling. The train of angry thoughts that stoke anger is also potentially the key to one of the most powerful ways to diffuse anger, undermining the convictions that are fueling the anger in the first place. Tice found that reframing a situation more positively was one of the most potent ways to put anger to rest. That finding squares well with the conclusions of University of Alabama psychologist Dolph Zillman, who sees two main ways of intervening. One way of diffusing anger is to seize on and challenge the thoughts that trigger the surges of anger, since it's the original appraisal of an interaction that confirms and encourages that first burst of anger and the subsequent reappraisals that fan the flames. Timing matters. The earlier in the anger cycle, the more effective. Indeed, anger can be completely short-circuited if the mitigating information comes before the anger is acted on. Here's some relevant testimony. "Once when I was about 13, in an angry fit, I walked out of the house vowing I would never return. It was a beautiful summer day, and I walked far along lovely lanes till gradually the stillness and beauty calmed and soothed me, and after some hours I returned repentant and almost melted. Since then, when I'm angry, I do this, if I can, and I find it the best cure. That account is by a subject in one of the very first scientific studies of anger, done in 1899. It still stands as a model of a second way of de-escalating anger, cooling off physiologically by waiting out the adrenal surge in a setting where there are not likely to be further triggers for rage. But a cooling down period won't work if that time is used to pursue the train of anger-inducing thought, since each such thought is in itself a minor trigger for more cascades of anger. The power of distraction is that it stops that angry train of thought. Catharsis, that is, giving vent to rage, is sometimes extolled as a way of handling anger. The popular theory holds that it makes you feel better, but as Zillman's findings suggest, there's an argument against catharsis. It's been made since the 1950s when psychologists started to test the effects of catharsis experimentally, and time after time found that giving vent to anger did little or nothing to dispel it. Tice found that ventilating anger is one of the worst ways to cool down. Outbursts of rage typically pump up the emotional brain's arousal, leaving people feeling more angry, not less. As I once heard Chogyam Trungpa, a Tibetan teacher, reply when asked how best to handle anger, "Don't suppress it, but don't act on it." "Oh no, the muffler sounds bad. What if I have to take it to the shop? I can't afford the expense. I'd have to draw the money from Jamie's college fund. What if I can't afford his tuition? That bad school report last week. What if his grades go down and he can't get into college? That muffler sounds so bad." And so the worrying mind spins on in an endless loop of low-grade melodrama, one set of concerns leading on to the next and back again. That last specimen was offered by Elizabeth Romer and Thomas Borkovec, Pennsylvania State University psychologists, whose research on worrying, the heart of all anxiety, has raised the topic from neurotics art to science. There is, of course, no hitch when worry works. By mulling over a problem, a solution might appear. Worry is, in a sense, a rehearsal of what might go wrong and how to deal with it. The difficulty is with chronic, repetitive worries, the kind that recycle on and never get any nearer a positive solution. When this same cycle of worry intensifies and persists, it shades over the line into full-blown neural hijackings, the anxiety disorders, phobias, obsessions and compulsions, panic attacks. In all these conditions, the common denominator is worry run amok. Chronic worriers worry about a wide range of things, most of which have almost no chance of happening. They read dangers into life's journey that others never notice. The one thing that chronic worriers cannot do is follow the advice they're most often given. That's to just stop worrying. But after much experimentation, Borkovec discovered some simple steps that can help even the most chronic worrier control the habit. The first step is self-awareness, catching the worrisome episodes as near their beginning as possible, ideally as soon as or just after the fleeting catastrophic image triggers the worry-anxiety cycle. Borkovec trains people in this approach by first teaching them to monitor cues for anxiety, as well as the accompanying sensations of anxiety in their body. Worriers also need to actively challenge the worrisome thoughts. Failing this, the worry spiral will keep coming back. So the next step is to take a critical stance toward their assumptions. Is it very probable that the dreaded event will occur? Is it necessarily the case that there's only one or no alternative to letting it happen? Are there constructive steps to be taken? Does it really help to run through these same anxious thoughts over and over? On the other hand, for people with worries so severe they've flowered into phobia, obsessive-compulsive disorder, or panic disorder, it may be prudent, indeed a sign of self-awareness, to turn to medication to interrupt the cycle. The single mood people generally put most effort into shaking is sadness. Diana Tice found that people are most inventive when it comes to trying to escape the blues. Of course, not all sadness should be escaped. Melancholy, like every other mood, has its benefits. The sadness that a loss brings has certain invariable effects. It closes down our interest in diversions and pleasures, fixes attention on what's been lost, and saps our energy for starting new endeavors, at least for the time being. Bereavement is useful. Full-blown depression is not. William Styron renders an eloquent description of the many dreadful manifestations of the disease, among them the self-hatred, a sense of worthlessness, a dank joylessness with gloom crowding in on me, a sense of dread and alienation, and above all, a stifling anxiety. In such major depression, life is paralyzed. No new beginnings emerge. The very symptoms of depression bespeak a life on hold. For Styron, no medication or therapy helped. It was the passing of time and the refuge of a hospital that finally cleared away the despondency. For most people, especially those with less severe cases, psychotherapy can help, as can medication. Prozac is the treatment of the hour, but there are more than a dozen other compounds offering some help, especially for major depression. My focus here is the far more common sadness, ordinary melancholy. This is a range of despondency that people can handle on their own if they have the internal resources. Tice found the most popular tactic for battling depression is socializing, going out to eat, to a ball game or movie, in short, doing something with friends or family. One of the main determinants of whether a depressed mood will persist or lift is the degree to which people ruminate. Stanford psychologist Susan Nolan Hoekspa, who has studied rumination in depressed people, finds women are far more prone to ruminate when they're depressed than are men. This, she proposes, may at least partly explain the fact that women are diagnosed with depression twice as often as men, though men may drown their depression in alcoholism, for which their rate is about twice that of women. Cognitive therapy, aimed at changing these thought patterns, has been found in some studies to be on a par with medication for treating mild clinical depression and superior to medication in preventing the return of mild depression. Two strategies are particularly effective in the battle. One is to learn to challenge the thoughts at the center of rumination, to question their validity and think of more positive alternatives. The other is to purposely schedule pleasant, distracting events. Diane Tice found that many people reported turning to distractions such as reading, TV and movies, video games and puzzles, sleeping, and daydreams such as planning a fantasy vacation. Another constructive approach to mood lifting, Tice reports, is engineering a small triumph for easy success, tackling some long-delayed chore around the house or getting to some other duty they've been wanting to clear up. One of the most potent and, outside therapy, little-used antidotes to depression is seeing things differently or cognitive reframing. It's all too easy to bemoan the end of a relationship and wallow in self-pitying thoughts like the conviction that this means I'll always be alone, but it's sure to thicken the sense of despair. But stepping back and thinking about the ways the relationship wasn't so great, ways you and your partner didn't click, in other words, seeing the loss differently in a more positive light, is an antidote to the sadness. Another effective depression lifter is helping others in need. Throwing oneself into volunteer work, coaching Little League, being a big brother, feeding the homeless, was one of the most powerful mood changers in Tice's study. But it's also one of the rarest. Finally, at least some people are able to find relief from their melancholy in turning to a transcendent power. Tice told me that praying, if you're very religious, works for all moods, especially depression. Just once in my life have I been paralyzed by fear. The occasion was a calculus exam during my freshman year in college, for which I somehow had managed not to study. As I opened the blue cover of my exam book, there was a thump in my ears of heartbeat. There was the taste of anxiety in the pit of my stomach. I looked at the exam questions once, quickly. Hopeless. For an hour, I stared at that page, my mind racing over the consequences I'd suffer. What strikes me most about that dreadful moment was how constricted my mind became. I didn't spend the hour in a desperate attempt to patch together some semblance of answers to the test. I didn't daydream. I simply sat fixated on my terror, waiting for the ordeal to finish. That narrative of an ordeal by terror is my own. To this day, it's for me the most convincing evidence of the devastating impact of emotional distress on mental clarity. I now see that my ordeal was most likely a testament to the power of the emotional brain to overpower, even paralyze, the thinking brain. When emotions overwhelm concentration, what's being swamped is working memory, the ability to hold in mind all information relevant to the task at hand. On the other hand, consider the role of positive motivation, the marshaling of feelings of enthusiasm, zeal, and confidence in achievement. Studies of Olympic athletes, world-class musicians, and chess grandmasters find their unifying trait is the ability to motivate themselves to pursue relentless training routines. For world-level competitors, these rigorous training routines now increasingly have to begin in childhood. The added payoff for life success for motivation can be seen in the remarkable performance of Asian students in American schools and professions. One thorough review of the evidence suggests that Asian American children have an average IQ advantage over whites of just 2 or 3 points, but the careers they enter, like dentistry, suggest an IQ advantage of 10 or 20 points. The reason seems to be that from the earliest years of school, Asian children work harder than whites. Sanford Dornbush, a Stanford sociologist who studied more than 10,000 high school students, found that Asian Americans spent 40% more time doing homework than did other students. Their families believe that anyone can do well in school with the right effort. In short, a strong cultural work ethic translates into higher motivation, zeal, and persistence. That's an emotional edge. Just imagine you're 4 years old and someone makes the following proposal. If you'll wait until after he runs an errand, you can have 2 marshmallows for a treat. If you can't wait until then, you can have only one, but you can have it right now. It's a challenge sure to try the soul of any 4-year-old, a microcosm of the eternal battle between impulse and restraint, id and ego, desire and self-control, gratification and delay. Which of these choices a child makes is a telling test. It offers a quick reading not just of character, but of the trajectory that child will probably take through life. In a remarkable study during the 1960s at a preschool on the Stanford University campus, the marshmallow challenge was posed to 4-year-olds. It shows just how fundamental is the ability to restrain the emotions and so delay impulse. Some 4-year-olds were able to wait what must surely have seemed an endless 15 to 20 minutes for the experimenter to return. To sustain themselves in their struggle, they covered their eyes so they wouldn't have to stare at temptation, or rested their heads in their arms, talked to themselves, sang, played games with their hands and feet, even tried to go to sleep. These plucky preschoolers got the 2-marshmallow reward. But others, more impulsive, grabbed that 1 marshmallow almost within seconds of the experimenter's leaving the room on his so-called errand. The diagnostic power of how this moment of impulse was handled became clear some 12 to 14 years later when these same children were tracked down as adolescents. The emotional and social difference between the grab-the-marshmallow preschoolers and their gratification-delaying peers was dramatic. Those who had resisted temptation at 4 were now, as adolescents, more socially competent, personally effective, self-assertive, and better able to cope with the frustrations of life. They embraced challenges and were self-reliant and confident, trustworthy and dependable. And more than a decade later, they were still able to delay gratification in pursuit of their goals. The 3 or so who grabbed for the marshmallow, however, tended to have fewer of these qualities and shared instead a relatively more troubled psychological portrait. In adolescence, they were more likely to be seen as shying away from social contacts, to be stubborn and indecisive, to be easily upset by frustrations, to think of themselves as bad or unworthy. And after all those years, they still were unable to put off gratification. Most astonishingly, those who had waited patiently at 4 had dramatically higher scores on their SAT tests, a 210-point advantage. At age 4, how children do on this test of delay of gratification is twice as powerful a predictor of what their eventual SAT scores will be as is IQ at age 4. IQ becomes a stronger predictor of SAT only after children learn to read. This suggests that the ability to delay gratification contributes powerfully to intellectual potential, quite apart from IQ itself. College students propose the following hypothetical situation. Although you set your goal of getting a B when your first exam score, that's worth 30% of your final grade, comes back, you've received a D. It's now 1 week after you learned about the D. What do you do? Hope made all the difference. The response by students with high levels of hope was to work harder and think of a range of things they could try that might bolster their final grade. Students with moderate levels of hope thought of several ways they might up their grade, but had far less determination to pursue them. And, understandably, students with low levels of hope gave up on both counts, demoralized. From the perspective of emotional intelligence, having hope means that one will not give in to overwhelming anxiety, a defeatist attitude, or depression in the face of difficult challenges or setbacks. Indeed, people who are hopeful evidence less depression than others as they maneuver through life in pursuit of their goals. They're less anxious in general, and they have less emotional distress. One of the most telling demonstrations of the power of optimism to motivate people is a study Martin Seligman, a psychologist at the University of Pennsylvania, did of insurance salesmen with the MetLife Company. Being able to take a rejection with grace is essential in sales of all kinds, especially with a product like insurance, where the ratio of no's to yes's can be so discouragingly high. For this reason, about 3/4 of insurance salesmen quit in their first 3 years. Seligman found that new salesmen who were by nature optimists sold 37% more insurance in their first 2 years on the job than did pessimists. And during that first year, the pessimists quit at twice the rate of the optimists. Just why optimism makes such a difference in sales success speaks to the sense in which it's an emotionally intelligent attitude. Each no a salesperson gets is a small defeat. The emotional reaction to that defeat is crucial to the ability to marshal enough motivation to continue. As the no's mount up, morale can deteriorate, making it harder and harder to pick up the phone for the next call. Such rejection is especially hard to take for a pessimist, who interprets it as meaning, I'm a failure at this, I'll never make a sale, an interpretation that's sure to trigger apathy and defeatism, if not depression. Optimists, on the other hand, tell themselves, I'm using the wrong approach, or that last person was just in a bad mood. By seeing not themselves, but something in the situation as the reason for their failure, they can change their approach in the next call. While the pessimist's mental set leads to despair, the optimist spawns hope. A composer describes those moments when his work is at its best. You're in an ecstatic state to such a point that you feel as though you almost don't exist. I've experienced this time and again. My hand seems devoid of myself. I have nothing to do with what's happening. I just sit there watching in a state of awe and wonderment, and it just flows out by itself. His description is remarkably similar to those of hundreds of diverse men and women, rock climbers, chess champions, surgeons, basketball players, engineers, managers, even filing clerks, when they tell of a time they outdid themselves in some favorite activity. The state they describe is called flow by Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, the University of Chicago psychologist who has collected such accounts of peak performance during 2 decades of research. Athletes know this state of grace as the zone, where excellence becomes effortless, crowd and competitors disappearing into a blissful, steady absorption in the moment. Being able to enter flow is emotional intelligence at its best. Flow represents perhaps the ultimate in harnessing the emotions in the service of performance and learning. In flow, the emotions are not just contained and channeled, but positive, energized, aligned with the task at hand. To be caught in the ennui of depression or the agitation of anxiety is to be barred from flow. Because flow emerges in the zone in which an activity challenges people to the fullest of their capacities, as their skills increase, it takes a heightened challenge to get into flow. If a task is too simple, it's boring. If too challenging, the result is anxiety rather than flow. Howard Gardner, the Harvard psychologist who developed the theory of multiple intelligences, sees flow and the positive states that typify it as part of the healthiest way to teach children, motivating them from the inside rather than by threat or promise of reward. We should use kids' positive states to draw them into learning in the domains where they can develop competencies, Gardner proposed to me. Flow is an internal state that signifies a kid is engaged in a task that's right. You have to find something you like and stick to it. It's when kids get bored in school that they fight and act up, and when they're overwhelmed by a challenge that they get anxious about their schoolwork. But you learn at your best when you have something you care about and get pleasure from being engaged in. Back to Gary, the brilliant but alexithymic surgeon who so distressed his fiancée, Ellen, by being oblivious not only to his own feelings, but to hers as well. Like most alexithymics, he lacked empathy as well as insight. Empathy builds on self-awareness. The more open we are to our own emotions, the more skilled we'll be in reading other people's. Alexithymics like Gary are emotionally tone-deaf. That capacity, the ability to know how another feels, comes into play in a vast array of life arenas, from sales and management to romance and parenting to compassion and political action. The absence of empathy is also telling. Its lack is seen in criminal psychopaths, rapists, and child molesters.